Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. Welcome. I'm your host, Cyrus Polysbon, and I'm joined today by Zohar Atkins and Nicolas Sarian. Welcome, guys. Today's quote that we're going to cover is, "The rule proves nothing. The exception proves everything," by Carl Schmitt from Political Theology. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I know this is like right up our alley, so I know that Zohar can speak for an hour about this.
Who is Carl Schmitt? Carl Schmitt was a legal philosopher, German, 20th century, a Catholic, although somewhat of an unorthodox Catholic. And most notorious because not only was he a member of the Nazi Party, but he used his legal philosophy and his political philosophy, which he came up with before Nazism, to justify Nazism. He was a critic of liberalism, so an anti-liberal thinker. However, despite being a Nazi, both in deed and in thought, his influence has been great in 20th century thought, even outside of Nazism, including on liberal political philosophy, which sees his criticisms as a worthy adversary, something to take seriously and something to think about why it's wrong. And although he was a right winger, his thought has also had a lot of influence on the anti-liberal left. I will summarize some of the ideas that are interesting in his work. Then we should think about whether they lead necessarily to Nazism or fascism or somewhere bad, or whether there's something in them that is useful and that needn't lead to such a toxic place. So Schmitt has a couple themes that he returns to and over and over. One of the themes is the idea that politics is a fundamental good, that being a political animal is part of human nature, and that the problem with liberal societies is that they try to minimize politics and they act as if we are apolitical animals, and or they treat politics as just one domain amongst other domains, like alongside of economics or social life, etc., instead of imagining that sort of part of what it is to be human fundamentally is to be political, and that this is just an unassailable part of our nature. Now, once you accept that thesis, what comes with his definition of politics is the decision over who is your friend and who is your enemy. But you always have friends and you always have enemies. And obviously, this is a certain bellicose view of the world, as in it's a virtue to be martial. It's a virtue to be conflictual. And he would say that liberalism is hypocritical because it too has friends and enemies, but in contrast to his martial values, it denies that it chooses who its friends are and who its enemies are. And it acts as if everybody is a friend. In reality, liberal societies are friends with other liberal societies and enemies with anti-liberal societies, but they just won't admit it. So that's another interesting point he makes. And then the one that I'm most interested in, and the one that touches on this quotation, which is from his work, Political Theology. What the heck is political theology? What does that mean? Well, it's not political philosophy, which is the more obvious term that we use when talking about the theory of politics. So what is political theology? Well, this is core to all of it, which is, in a sense, the idea that our political structures and our political metaphors have their origins not in Athens, not in the Socratic method, not in the method of philosophy, which is the search for truth based upon self-reflection, but rather in God, in our view of how the world is metaphysically, and that human conceptions of who has power, who should power, actually derive from, let's say, a certain view on how God wields power. And even in a secular society, What we have is not a rejection of theology, but just a smuggling of theological concepts into our secular vernacular, and then we've repressed the theological basis of this understanding. And you find this theme in Leo Strauss, who is his contemporary and with whom he engaged in correspondence. And you also find this idea in Walter Benjamin, who famously, in one of his essays called A Thesis on the Philosophy of History, begins with this really amazing image of, and Benjamin was a kind of unorthodox Marxist, certainly anti-fascist. Benjamin imagines that there's a chessboard and there's a puppet that is playing the chess, an automaton actually. Not a puppet, I should say. Automaton is sort of like a very primitive version of AI. this is before Deep Blue, but hidden in the wings and operating the automaton is a tiny hunchback that nobody can see. And so everyone's focused on the automaton and like, wow, that's so cool. It's this little robot that's playing chess, but no one sees that the robot itself has a hidden human behind it. And this human is kept out of sight so that we can all focus on the robot and delight in its tricks. And this is a parable. And the parable is that the hunchback who's hidden from view is theology. And the automaton is, in his words, historical materialism, which is just a fancy way of saying Marxist analysis. So the point being that everybody in Benjamin's age is talking about class conflict and owners and proletariats and this kind of thing, because that's the super determined narrative through which people want to process their experience. And it's considered passé, it's considered gauche to process the world through theological concepts, just as the concept of, you know, the reality of a hunchback who once upon a time had a certain monstrosity, but also a certain dignity, was seen as a creature of God, is now kept out of view in some way. And it's sort of like people don't want to deal with these people that scramble our categories, and they don't want to deal with concepts that scramble the categories. So theology is now verboten. And so he shares this in common with Schmitt in the sense that they both think that actually theology plays a prominent role in the way we understand the world, but we're in self-denial about it. So that's a little bit of an overview of Schmitt. And then in terms of what this quote is saying, so Schmitt believes that the sovereign is defined not by the decisions he makes, but specifically the decisions that he makes when he is overriding the rules that are written down or the rules on the books. And so he famously says the sovereign is the one who decides on the state of exception. The rule proves nothing, the exception proves everything, because if the rule proved everything, then you wouldn't need a sovereign. You could just essentially be on autopilot, right? You could just hit the autopilot button on the Tesla and let it drive you. But as long as there's a moment where the car could actually crash and someone has to take the wheel, that's the only moment that counts, and that's the exception. That's when the algorithm doesn't work. That's what you want in a leader, not the one who's just going to do the autopilot thing, but the one who's going to say, now is different, it's an emergency. And of course, you can see why this links up with the principle of dictatorship and can lead to some problematic areas. But he actually analogizes the exceptionalism of the sovereign, the earthly sovereign, to God doing a miracle, whereby, let's say there's a state of nature or laws of nature. Most of the time, you drop an apple from a tree, it falls to the ground. But if you believe that God is above nature, then God can decide for the apple to levitate or for the apple to go up instead of to go down. And it's just an illusion that the laws of nature apply. They apply 99 times out of 100, but what counts is the exception to the laws of nature. So just as God overrides the laws of nature, so the Schmittian sovereign can override the laws of man. And I'll turn it over to Nico for his thoughts on all this. But before I do, I think one point of challenge on Schmitt's view there are so many points in which we could criticize him, but his definition of the miracle as the exception to nature is one way that you could define a miracle, but it's not the way that every theologian has defined miracles. In fact, there are theologians such as Franz Rosenzweig, a contemporary or near contemporary of his, who thinks that the miracles don't contradict nature. Rather, miracles are about fulfilling a promise that you made and more about timing than exception. So to make it concrete, right now, Jews are reading the story of the Exodus from Egypt in the Torah, in the weekly Torah reading. And a core sort of moment in this narrative is the splitting of the Red Sea, through which the Israelites walk. They walk through a sea that's split and they get to dry land, and behind them, the Egyptians come after them and the sea swallows their pursuers. And it's one of the most spectacular moments, probably the, you know, if there's any moment you're going to pick in the Torah to be supernatural about, this would be it, splitting a sea and walking through a sea with walls of water on both sides of you. So that's what you should have in mind if you're a Schmidtian, is that just as God can do that to the sea, so the sovereign can do that to the Constitution. However, according to Franz Rosenzweig, he says it's not supernatural that the sea was split. It happens from time to time that a strong wind can come and you can have a sea that by the laws of nature, without having to go supernatural, can be split. The only thing that's miraculous is that this natural event, which is rare, happened at the moment when the Israelites needed it. So you can see that the miracle is the aligning of the laws of nature with the need for nature to reveal that affordance in a time of need. And so that almost defines miracle in terms of serendipity. Like, coincidences happen all the time. What distinguishes a coincidence from a miracle or makes a miracle is when I so desperately need this coincidence and it happens. And it's so coincidental, it's so needed, that the only way that I can possibly account for it is that God intervened in my behalf, but God didn't have to supersede the law in order to do it. So I give that not as the only alternative, but just to say, I think if we want to go down the theological rabbit hole, we need to ask, what is a miracle? And if there are other definitions of miracles, then maybe there are other models for sovereignty that don't involve suspending the law and becoming a Führer, which is how Schmidt interpreted it. What do you think, Nico?
My way of understanding the whole miracle thing because in political theology, yes, as you said, Zohar, I mean, one of the kind of big phrases of Schmidt is when he says that all our modern concepts for the state are secularized theological concepts. Like, that's a one-liner you find in political theology. Basically, that the idea that all of our ideas for modern governance, or like a lot of them, I guess, are derived from theology. And the interesting thing there is that, I mean, I find this manifested in the work of Augustine, because in Augustine, the city of God, right? The big work by Augustine, besides the Confessions. One of the main splits, and this is a Platonic thing, is that there's two worlds. There's the world of man, and then there's the world of God. And the world of man has its own laws, which are in a sense derived from the world of God, but they're not the same. It's the city of God versus the city of man. And a miracle happens when God intervenes in the laws of man, which is an unprecedented event. And that in itself can be a definition for a miracle, because the laws of this world are being broken. I mean, they're not being broken or bent, but there is an event that happens which is unprecedented by the law. And in politics, this is an amazing way of understanding contemporary politics. Like, and I have a few examples, but like, I think the most pressed one is COVID. I mean, one of the other good examples, which is analyzed thoroughly by a guy who was very influenced by Schmidt, who's Giorgio Agamben, was 9/11 and the subsequent invasion of Iraq and you know, war powers and all these things. It's like when you declare an emergency, it's because there is a situation that is overriding. I mean, it's sort of overriding the laws, but it's not being premeditated by the law code. So what that implies is that the sovereign, in this case, let's say at that time it was George Bush, needs to declare war powers or a state of emergency to deal with the situation, which means that he can override the code of law. I believe that COVID, and this is something that George Ugamben got a lot of, he was fairly critiqued for it, is the same. Because you have something that is obscure, mysterious, nobody knows what's going on, what's the deal with this virus, and blah, blah, blah. And that generates a response from the sovereign, which is, I need to exert power beyond the law in order to manage this situation. Whatever the stakes, consequences of it, be, you know? I think this is like, because like Schmitt, or let's say the term political theology can sound like a, it sounds like theology, but it's really not. It's about politics. It's about the way we rule, we govern ourselves, or we are governed. And it's like an infinite conversation, really, because it has so many applications in today's world. I can, like, another example that I love is, like, I'm from Argentina, and Argentina is in a perpetual state of emergency because there's, you know, a political crisis, there's economic crisis, there's a food crisis, there's, like, all these crises. And in order for the government to manage them, the only way it can do it is to declare a state of emergency. So you have like 8 to 9 like perennial emergencies that they used to rule the country. I mean, they used to govern the country, which has nothing to do with the constitution. It has nothing to do with the rule of law. And that's how it's been going on for like the past 50 years. And you know, Zohar was saying that although Schmitt is a right-wing, conservative, anti-liberal thinker, he has been appropriated by the non-liberal left. No, and one of the big influences on Argentine politics, or especially like peronismo, or like, you know, like central left to left, is a guy called Ernesto Laclau, who was a Argentine French. I don't like him very much. I know Zohar is green. who was basically conversant with the sovereign at the time, you know? So like the politics were designed following Schmitt, in a sense, with this friend and foe dynamic, and the country was governed like that for at least 20 years. So I think it's extremely relevant.
I want to talk about this Schmittian point at the personal level as well as the political level, because the personal level I agree with it. I think firstly at the political level, Schmitt is saying that constitutionalism is hypocritical, because what really happens is not when you follow the constitution, but when you choose not to follow the constitution. That's what defines a society. And in fact, just from a historical basis, Article 29 of, I believe, the Weimar Constitution grants you the ability as the sovereign to suspend the constitution when the state is at risk. And so this is a technical point, but essentially, at least at the beginning of Nazism and maybe throughout, the Weimar Constitution, which was a liberal constitution, remained on the books. But the Nazis simply invoked this 29th article to suspend the other rights in order to preserve the state. So the point is not that that was a good thing, obviously. The point is it should make you afraid and wonder, okay, well, given that you could maintain a liberal veneer while becoming anti-liberal in practice, this is how I relate to it. I see Schmitt as a critic of liberalism who's holding a mirror up to us about the fragility of liberalism. So what makes you so sure that your constitution can actually protect you from staying perfectly on the books, but in reality leading us to fascism or totalitarianism? And there's a second question, which is, let's say you don't want to be ruled by a dictator, and you don't want to live in a society where civil liberties are suspended in the name of preserving the state. Like, it's not fun to live in a state of emergency, especially if you're deemed to be an enemy. If you're living in a society where the friend-enemy distinction is the only thing that decides everything, and you're deemed an enemy, that's not fun. Right? That's why we wanted to live in a liberal society that protects minorities. But you also want to live in a society where the leader has discretion and has the ability to use discernment, because in fact, there are emergencies and there are things that come up where just following the law isn't going to tell you what to do. This happens all the time. So how do you split the difference? How do you hedge against the downside risk that by giving the leader great power, it leads you to suspend the rights of the enemies of the state, with the fact that if you constrain the sovereign too much by the law or by formalism, then what ends up happening is you go on autopilot, to use the Tesla example, and you just crash the car. And so this is one of the things where there's like a meta debate. Like, if you take America, is the goal to have a stronger president, a stronger executive function? Everybody would say that yes, if their side is in power. The problem is, what happens when you lose and the other team is in power? So then you have to think about, given that they're going to use emergency power and executive order to sort of buff up their team, maybe you want to put certain protections in place so that people follow the principle rather than just follow the charisma of the leader. So to abstract a little bit, we're talking about charismatic leadership and creative leadership being sort of on a slippery slope that leads to dictatorship against technocracy and rule by laws and rule by algorithm, in which it shouldn't matter who's the president. You want to interchange Joe Biden with Joe Biden AI or Donald Trump and Nikki Haley. It doesn't matter, because ultimately it's the swamp that's deciding what's happening. It's not the president, is just a figurehead. He's just a mascot. It doesn't actually matter. So that's the political challenge. And then the personal, just to make it personal, I think this is where the wisdom is. Amazon knows what you want to buy. They profit from giving you that little recommendation box at the bottom of your screen that says, because you bought that book, you should buy this book. You bought that product, buy this product. And it's pretty good. And most people, I think, don't even think, oh, this is an invasion of privacy. They're like, oh, that was so helpful. How did you know I was looking for paper towels? Right? But the thing is, if you live your life in such a way that the algorithm can just take your data and tell you what you're going to do next, so you're not living an exceptional life. You're living a very ordinary life. You're living the life of beta. And I would say you're living a life that's scripted, a life where you have not demonstrated that you have free will. Maybe you feel free internally, but externally, like, you're basic. The rule proves nothing. The exception proves everything. There have to be certain moments in your life where you override the rule, and where Amazon gets it wrong and the people around you get it wrong. Your teachers, your parents, your friends, the people who know you, they all don't know you because you're the sovereign. You don't even know yourself. And those are the moments of freedom. So just as there's a constitution which can be suspended, which is its own rabbit hole, there's also, so to say, a constitution of yourself. Like, what would Cyrus do in this situation? For Cyrus to be free, for Nico to be free, the answer can't just be he should do what he's always done, because it's worked for him up until this moment. There has to be a forcing function where you do something radically new. and reinventive, because that's what the situation calls for, and actually become a new person as a result. And Hannah Arendt, who was actually one of the great Cold War liberal thinkers, although she was a lover and student of another Nazi, Heidegger, she came up with the concept of natality, which is related to natalism, you know, neonatal birth. Natality is the idea that there's in every lifetime events, social events that nobody could have predicted that radically change. That radically change everything for us. It could have, 9/11 wasn't just a form of natality because it led to the war in Iraq and the Patriot Act. It was also a mindset shift that it brought in, which is like, now we live in the era of the war against terror and all that means. Just as in a previous era, the falling of the Berlin Wall was a moment of natality, and before that, let's say the liberation of the Holocaust camps in 1945, or the bombing of Pearl Harbor, whatever. There are certain, or the assassination of JFK. Like, there are certain moments that, or the landing on the moon, that we remember, and you can remember that moment. Where were you when that happened? And they changed global consciousness, and you can never go back. There's like before, and there's after. And just as those moments of natality exist at the grand scale, so I think the Arendtian point and the Schmittian point is that they should exist at the micro level. There should be moments in your life that are inflection points that bring a certain natality, where there's a before and there's an after. And the Ishbitzer Rebbe, a great 19th century Hasidic thinker, he speaks about stages of adult development as being parallel to the stages of embryonic development. And so just as an embryo goes through different stages from just conception to actually becoming alive, so a human who's been born goes through stages of development where they're also formed. It's like almost like, if you want to think about it radically, you could be 25 years old and be in your fifth trimester, so to say. you're still being formed. And so the birth metaphor is actually fundamental to the story of development, which is to say, we're always in a process of being born, of getting to the next level. And that's why Schmitt is right, that the rule proves nothing, the exception proves everything, because the breaking of the rule is the moment where you get to the next level. That rule worked for the previous, let's say, era, the previous epoch, whether you think about that culturally or personally, but it doesn't work for now. What got you here won't get you there. And so maybe this anti-liberalism doesn't work, or because of the downside risk is my view, at the political level. Like, I think politics, in my personal view, should be more focused on minimizing the chance of wipeout and catastrophe than maximizing the chance of paradise on earth. I'm dispositionally conservative, but at the individual level, I think we should be risking it all and taking big bets, because it's our life, and we should bet on our freedom.
I have a few answers, or at least for the first. I know we should focus on the personal, because that's what matters to us at the end of the day. But my reading of Schmitt when it comes to the political question that you raised in the first part of your short speech is that what if the point of governance is not about governance but about keeping power in check, no? Because this is like the liberal project out of feudalism and monarchy. It arises through a separate division of the powers, so you can keep the sovereign in check. And this is how, like, also, you know, I was going to mention this as well, that in your what you were saying, like, you eventually, or you necessarily invoke the thought of Leo Strauss, or you have to invoke also Max Weber into this, because I mean, it's all interconnected, no? But one thing that I wanted to say is that I I mean, I get the point of like minimizing contingency, and that should be the task of governance, no? And instead of opening up, or let's say, fantasizing people, or like, you know, deluding people with achieving heaven on earth. But I think my point is that, or like the way that I read Schmidt on this is, and I'm thinking with Schmidt and a few other thinkers, especially anthropologists, who are like studying hunting and gather tribes and how power was disposed in those times. The idea that I'm trying to explain is that what if governance is about managing human ubris, let's say human. What's the English term for ubris? Hubris, right? It's the same thing, yeah. Which is, I mean, and that's kind of like central to the whole debate, which is, what does it mean to be a sovereign? And I mean, this is the interesting part about the part I find most interesting about Schmidt is that you don't really want to be the sovereign, because if sovereignty is as such the way that is described by Schmidt, that someone is deciding on the exception, then, and this is actually that Agamben reads onto Schmidt. It's not so explicit in Schmidt, but the sovereign herself is the exception, which means that they're in a margin all of the time. There's a famous line, I think it's Benjamin who wrote this, that the one who decides on the course of history necessarily has to be outside of history. As you know, if you want to write about history, you need to be outside of history, you know? And the issue there is, and this is why, like, remember Girard and generative scapegoating and all of this stuff? Well, the scapegoat necessarily has to be the sovereign, you know? All of the blame, all of the justifications for the failures of a regime should fall on one head. And we don't have this today. And I think this is a way of dealing with the question, which is saying that if you want power, you also have to face the consequences of having that power, of deciding on things, which means that any wrong step has a huge consequence on your life. I mean, there's a degree of this, I think, in leaders. But
that reminds me of the principle of skin in the game, where like in Hammurabi's code, for example, if you build a house and then the house collapses, so you get reciprocal punishment, where like, let's say they'll destroy your house or break your legs or something like this. Whereas today it's like, okay, you get sued and you mediate it with your corporation that pays out the damages if they even have the money. But you're protected from liability. So then you don't have the incentive to care. And essentially that's the culture we're at, right? Where you can make a decision that affects millions of people, but if you get it wrong, you don't get fired, you just get a different job. So I do take Nico's point as a kind of provocation, like we'll allow for a dictator if the dictator will sign a paper saying that if the people changes its mind, then he gets the guillotine.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the point. I mean, it's more of a monarchic system that I'm thinking here, you know, where like, if you get it wrong, you're done, you know? And, that's why, like, I mean, one of the say meta-philosophical or philosophical findings in Schmidt is that power lies in the margins at the end of the day. And this is later.
I'll tell you the problem with Schmidt, according to Leo Strauss, and then I'm going to have to go in like 4 or 5 minutes. But according to Strauss, Schmidt is a fake anti-liberal. So just as Schmidt is criticizing liberals and saying, you guys are fake liberals, you're actually anti-liberal, you're just self-denying it. Strauss gives basically the same criticism in reverse. And the reason is this: a true anti-liberal actually believes something, and it doesn't even cross their mind to be liberal. Like if you look at religious texts from 2,000 years ago, they're not like, should we put it up for a vote? I think the chances that we might be self-deluded are strong enough that maybe we should appeal to the wisdom of the crowd. No, like God says, do this. The prophet who's the authority hears that and makes it happen. And if you disagree, you're killed. That's just what happens. And I suppose if there's a conflict in that society and there are two prophets and each one claims that God told them what to do, then they have a civil war, and whoever wins the war, God was on their side. Schmidt doesn't actually tell us what is truth. He doesn't actually say God told me that this is the right way to do it. All he's saying is that the sovereign has the ability to decide what the truth is. In fact, that view is quite a secular view. The prophet in the ancient paradigm doesn't decide what truth is. The prophet hears it from God. He's subordinate to God. And there's a content to his worldview. It isn't just, oh, make a decision. That's what matters. So what Strauss criticizes Schmidt of is decisionism. Decisionism also is a criticism of existentialism in general. Decisionism is the worship of decision-making as the highest value, with no concern whatsoever for any criteria that should guide this decision. Religious people of old, in the pre-liberal days, were not decisionists. They had a substantial view of the world, and that enabled them to make certain decisions. They didn't care if those decisions were made democratically, but that's not the point. The point wasn't the decisionism. So what you end up getting from Schmidt is this idea that any decision is good as long as it's made decisively. I recently heard a version of this from a guy named Samo Berja, who has the concept of live players. And the idea is that a live player is basically like a Schmidtian sovereign, as opposed to everybody else who's like what they would say in video games is an NPC. Right. What's an NPC, Cyrus? Non-player character. So most people are NPCs, and then some people are live players. But the thing is, you could be a live player of the left, of the center, of the right. It doesn't matter. The only thing that determines whether you're a live player is whether, like, your life is sort of interesting enough that the Amazon algorithm couldn't predict it, that your decisions are interesting enough such that we would know from first principles, oh, what's he going to do on this? What's his position going to be on that? The person that, like, you know, because they support this cause, they also support these 10 other causes, that person's an NPC. The person where you're like, I wonder what they have to say about this issue, that's a live player. The point is, how can you make being a live player the goal? The goal should be having the truth. So essentially, Schmidt remains a liberal because he's neutral on the actual values as long as what you do is just be a sovereign. So he's not actually telling you how to be a good sovereign or defining what makes a good sovereign. He's just saying be a sovereign. And in that way, he's deeply modern and deeply continuous with Hobbes.
I would say that, like, I mean, I agree with everything, but I mean, if we think of Schmidt as a type of thinker, he's not a Plato. He's a Machiavelli, you know. And all of his work is, a lot of it is historical. Certainly, the early stuff, it's about studying ancient regimes and previous regimes and seeing how power was dealt with. He's not doing, let's say, a metaphysics of power. He's doing a historical account, or at least early stage Schmidt is doing a quasi-historical account of how governance worked in the past, and saying, well, liberalism is just a facade, really. It's the charismatic rulers who are marking the shifts in power. But at the end of the day, I mean, this is why. What was Machiavelli's famous residence in Italy? I don't expect you guys to know, but like he named his own house Machiavelli's house. So like if Schmidt should be understood as a sort of thinker, it should be as Machiavelli addressing the sovereign.
According to Strauss, he's a Hobbesian.
Right, of course.
Hobbes is the first liberal philosopher. And Strauss claims to be the last. And Strauss's point is he's more like Hobbes than he thinks. Like, it's all rhetoric. It's all bellicose. It's like the guy in the bar.
You mean Schmidt is the last liberal, not Strauss.
According to Strauss, Schmidt just completes the circle that Hobbes started, but he's not discontinuous with Hobbes. He's a continuation of Hobbes. Because in Hobbes, we have a liberal philosopher who gives us the concept of individual rights, but where those individuals basically then endow a sovereign with the ability to decide everything, so long as he just protects some of their basic rights, and those rights prove to be very minimal. In both Hobbes and in Schmidt, the goal is the sovereign, as opposed to what the sovereign is using his sovereignty for. And it just so happens that in Hobbes, the sovereign's supposed to use his sovereignty for peace, because we start in a state of war, and we want to coexist. So the sovereign helps us do this. Whereas in Schmidt, we start in a state of peace, of fake peace, where we're actually seething at one another, and the sovereign's job is to elicit our warlike nature and unleash it, because that is actually, it's good to express war in a part of our dignity. So we could talk about this for hours.
If you enjoyed, I mean, I was so happy to be a spectator in this one. If you enjoyed the conversation today, you can find it on our Chronicles WhatsApp group. The link is in the bio. Join it. Thanks for listening, guys. Bye.